Hello and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. We've got a busy show today. No time to waste. I don't even know if we can get through it all, but gosh, we're going to try. Oh, did I mention thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback? We simply cannot start a show until I've said that. Coming up, we're going to talk about a follow-up story that was done. So on January 6th, obviously there was the riot at the nation's capital, but there was also a breach of the governor's mansion in Washington State. And on January 6th, as part of coverage of that day, Crosscut, which is, I've said before, like the leftist Seattle Times, did this sort of very in-depth follow-up on what happened to the rioters who were there who broke the law at the governor's mansion. But I can't help but compare their coverage of this to their lack of coverage of the violence of some of the riots that happened in Seattle. And I'm just, I took this article very personally. So we're going to talk about it just coming up. Also, it's the first day of the new legislative session in Washington State, in case you weren't aware. Democrats are in a little bit of hot water, though, heading into the session, hot water with the press, that is, because they are taking extraordinary measures to hide records that should be accessible via public disclosure. And this is one of those things that I'm going to ask for your help on to make sure that these lawmakers do the right thing and don't get away with this. So it'll be a call to action sort of day. Also coming up, we talked a lot on the podcast about some of the lying candidates who won in November. Obviously, there's George Santos, the Republican out of New York's 3rd District, who has officially been sworn into Congress despite all measure of lies about his life. But it also, I think and I hope, has raised awareness for a candidate in Washington State, Democrat Clyde Shavers, who unseated a Republican incumbent in the 10th Legislative District in Washington. But he lied about his military service, he lied about being an attorney, and now there is a proposal from a former Washington State lawmaker to try to make sure that fewer lies can reach the eyes and ears of voters. So we'll have him on to discuss. Also, I said we would be talking about this story a lot more, so today is no different. There is a huge outcry in the city of Linwood, which is north of Seattle, because there is an opioid treatment clinic that's being shoved down their throats with little to no notice, and it is just yards from a Boys and Girls Club, which is supposed to be a safe space for teens. So the president of the Linwood City Council is going to join us to talk about his opposition to how all of this played out and what they're hoping will happen from here. But first, we're going to talk about and start with Biden's border visit. First, let me say, I'm glad he went to the border. I mean, how many people have just been down his throat to say, go to the border? Why hasn't he been to the border? Why hasn't he been to the border? So I'm glad he went. It's obviously too late. He should have done it sooner. But I think that we have to say, okay, good, he went, he got to see things. However, what a dog and pony show that was. So Biden gets to the border. He's in El Paso. And in December, we know how awful things were in El Paso. You know, there was this anticipation about the possible end of Title 42. And so folks were coming up, hoping it might be easier for them to get in. So the streets of El Paso were overrun. The shelters were overrun. And we saw images of it. And the Daily Mail had this great photography where they compared what some of these areas in El Paso looked like at the end of December, and then what they looked like during Biden's visit. And it's very clear that the city or the feds or someone went in there and cleared things out, cleaned things up. Now, you might argue, well, there's a security issue there. You can't have hordes of migrants lingering around while the president is walking on the border. Fine, you know, I want the president to be safe. But at the same time, he's not truly seeing the extent of things. You've given him this polished up version of reality. And maybe instead of, because we've seen this in Seattle, for instance, there's been some times where I've had interviews scheduled. There was one in particular where I had a formal interview with a mayor in Seattle down in Pioneer Square, which at the time was gross. And I went down there for the interview and I couldn't help but notice things look really nice, comparatively speaking, to how they've looked before. And I just had this suspicious feeling that because the mayor's office, you know, knew, oh, we're going to be down there doing this interview for television, I guarantee they sent crews down there to clean it up. And so it's this idea of, like, if reality is so bad that you've got to go in and clean things up before a dignitary gets there, maybe you ought to put some of that energy toward fixing the problem that made it look so bad in the first place. So it's a little annoying that this was all cleaned up and polished up and pretty looking for Biden. And then there's this video of him, you know, they always got these videos that are done just for the cameras of, you know, the president walking with Border Patrol agents. And this one video, he's walking, according to the person who shared it, in the parking lot of Customs and Border Protection. It's like, the president isn't going to see a lot in the CBP parking lot. You need to take that man, like, down to the trenches. He needs to spend some time, 5 minutes, with our friend Allie Bradley, actually seeing what's happening at the southern border. So a lot, I mean, I'm, again, glad he went down there. He, when he got to El Paso, he was greeted by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, which is great. You know, Greg Abbott's been very critical of the president. And in turn, the Biden administration has been very critical of some of what, you know, the busing, et cetera. So I was glad to see Greg Abbott go there, you know, take time to speak to the president, because if you're going to fix it, you have to work together. That's the bottom line. And so even if you don't like what each other has been doing and each other's politics, you have to fix the problem. So that was a nice moment. You know, and then Karine Jean-Pierre, and this will be my last note on this, the White House press secretary, she just continues this insane level of gaslighting. You know, she's asked in the White House press briefing about the situation on the border and all of that and how bad things have become. And I mean, all I think most Americans want to hear is you to just be honest, even if it doesn't make the president look particularly good, because otherwise it's so transparently dishonest. I would like her to say, look, you know, the border is an issue right now. It is a humanitarian crisis. It's a security crisis. Anyone looking at the pictures knows that the southern border is not secure. But this is what we're doing to fix it. That's really all I want to hear from the administration. And instead, you know, she does everything she can to just tap dance, gaslight, push the blame onto other people, you know, blame former President Donald Trump. It's like, I don't care. Even if you're blaming people whose fault it really is, when you are, you know, I'm talking about like President Biden, the White House and the administration, when you're in charge, most powerful entity in the world, you've asked for, you've taken on the responsibility saying, you know, I'm going to help solve these problems. So every problem is your problem. And I don't know what it's going to take to get back to a place where you have elected leaders who really feel that level of culpability for everything, even if they weren't directly to blame for it, who really feel the gravity of the responsibility that they asked for when they ran for office. So I'm really disappointed in the way that this administration has handled, has talked about, has messaged on the issue of the southern border, because every single American who's operating in good faith knows it's a problem and they just want to know what you're going to do to fix it. All right, the legislative session starts today in Washington State, and we already have kind of an idea of some of the things that they're going to prioritize or maybe not prioritize. You know, I've been keeping my eye very closely on the public safety issues. The legislature in Washington State, in just the rush of the kind of anti-police sentiment, passed all these bills in 2021 that I think have been disastrous to public safety. A bill making it nearly impossible for police to pursue suspects. They had a little band-aid over something called the Blake decision, which, if you're not familiar, it was a Washington State Supreme Court decision that essentially nullified our felony drug possession law. And so right now, it's nearly impossible for police to arrest someone on a felony or misdemeanor drug possession charge under state statute. So it has really created a problem for the kind of carrot and a stick approach, because the homeless crisis is a drug crisis, let's be honest about it. And when you have police who are forced to, basically under the band-aid passed by the legislature, over and over offer someone help, but there is no possibility that, you know, right away that the alternative is jail, then they're going to be like, no, because they're in their drug-induced psychosis. So it's all just a bummer. And I have heard that there is some bipartisan interest in finding a better fix to the Blake decision, which I'm very happy about. Apparently, there's a lot of conversations happening behind the scenes. So I'm going to give the two sides the benefit of the doubt that they are engaging on that issue in a meaningful way. Fingers crossed. But I still have seen jack on the police pursuit bill, which is really disappointing to me. And, you know, you had Democrats act like they cared about public safety in the lead up to November election. And if they don't fix that police pursuit bill, then they don't care about public safety at all, in my opinion. So a couple things. There was this Crosscut Elway poll that was released ahead of the legislative session that talked to about 400 registered Washington voters about what their what they want to see lawmakers prioritize. And so it's a good gauge of, hey, where's the public at heading into this legislative session? Thankfully, COVID was nowhere close to the top of the list. Only 2% said that that is the biggest issue they want prioritized. So, I mean, praise Jesus on that. The most important issue for voters, and this is so interesting to me. Top three issues: the economy, public safety, homelessness. Fourth issue, taxes. The economy, public safety, homelessness, taxes. Now, which party would have a significantly different approach than the current one to the economy, public safety, homelessness, taxes? Republicans, right? If those are four things that are on the top of your list, because presumably you put them at the top of your list because you're not happy with the state of things, then you would want the party that's not in charge, you'd want to hear their ideas, right? Because obviously the party in charge isn't doing a good job, or else those issues wouldn't be at the top of your list because they wouldn't be priorities. But then you go further in this poll, and at the same time that they're saying the economy, public safety, homelessness, and taxes are what they want lawmakers prioritizing, you also have overwhelming support for Governor Jay Inslee in this poll, which I'm like, the man's been the governor for 10 years. Why? I don't understand. If you're prioritizing all the issues he's made worse, like public safety and homelessness and increase in taxes, I think our economy has been fairly strong, then why would you have such faith in him to do a good job? For instance, so there was a question asked, overall, how would you rate the job Governor Inslee is doing as governor? And I will say that this wasn't wonderful. 13% said excellent, 33% said good, 15% said fair, 37% said poor. And I looked at it and say, okay, maybe they don't think he's doing a great job. But then there was a follow-up question that said, Mr. Inslee is in the middle of his third term as governor. Although the election is still 2 years away, as of today, are you inclined to support him for another term? 34% said yes. And then 17% said they would support a different Democrat. So 51% today say they would either support Governor Jay Inslee for an unprecedented fourth term, as if it makes sense in any realm to have the same person lead the state for 16 years. 51%, even though you're telling us with your priorities, the economy, public safety, homelessness, and taxes, that you're not happy with what's going on those issues. And you think that somehow Governor Jay Inslee or another Democrat is going to solve them better than the Democrats that are in charge right now? That just doesn't make sense to me. I try to wrap my mind around that. And we talked about this in the podcast. Like, I'm worried about the state of the Republican Party. I'm not a Republican. I think that they need to decide who they are and they need to message it very forcefully. But what would the harm be, I guess? What would the harm be in putting a Republican in charge for 4 years? Like, you've had Inslee by the time he leaves office, because I don't think he's going to run again, for 12. Okay. Let's just say you give a Republican 4 years, just four, to just see what happens. See what happens on your priorities, the economy, public safety, homelessness, taxes. What really do you believe is the worst that could happen? Are you worried about abortion? Nothing would happen with abortion. They would have to have the House, the Senate, the governor's mansion, and they wouldn't be able to even get enough votes with all the moderate Republicans who support abortion rights. So I don't understand what people are so worried about. I don't understand what people are so fearful about just saying, let's try something different for 4 years and see if things go a little better. So anyway, where the mind of voters are is interesting to me. And look, I know, I'm not going to say people's opinions are wrong, but it does, like, when I look at those numbers, I'm sort of like, that doesn't add up to me. So anyway, another thing happening this legislative session that I want all of you to take action on, I wrote about it in my Sunday newsletter, and it's just such a critically important issue. So a lot of the time when we're requesting as members of the media information from elected leaders, if we feel like we're hitting a wall, if we feel like we're not being told the whole truth, we have an ace up our sleeve. We have the Public Records Act. And we can, and even members of the public can, request records, emails, documents, text messages, voicemails from government officials and government workers. And I think that's a really important part of transparency, an important part of our democracy, that these things can see the light of day, and that what lawmakers are doing and leaders are doing can't be hidden from us. But, and there's been a long running battle over this in Washington state. So back in 2018, just to catch you up on the history of this, back in 2018, lawmakers in Olympia had the gall to pass a bill that exempted them from the Public Records Act. They exempted themselves from the Public Records Act. People lost it. I mean, Washingtonians by the tens of thousands reached out, sent emails, made phone calls, and the pushback was so great that Governor Inslee actually vetoed it, which was wonderful. They absolutely felt the pressure on the issue. And then members of the media came forward, media organizations, and they made sure this issue made it to the Washington State Supreme Court. And the Washington State Supreme Court, they said, yes, of course, lawmakers are subject to public disclosure. And so that should have been the end of the issue. It should have been a non-issue from there. But in the last few months, Democrats in Olympia, a few of them, have been using something that they're calling legislative privilege to withhold the release of certain documents. So this has raised alarm bells from entities like the Seattle Times editorial board, which put out just a scathing op-ed about how lawmakers are just making up this legislative privilege, how it has no basis in the Constitution. There's no place in the Public Records Act that gives them quote-unquote legislative privilege to withhold these documents. And Democrats are sort of disagreeing. They're saying, well, our attorneys say that this is covered in the Constitution, but basically they're taking this wording in the Constitution that it's Article 2, Section 17 of the state Constitution. It reads, freedom of debate. No member of the legislature shall be liable in any civil action or criminal prosecution for words spoken in debate. So the state constitution basically protects them from civil litigation for what they might say during debate on a bill, okay? And that allows them to like have some freedom to discuss issues and, you know, work through things, but it has nothing to do with you know, them saying that some of these documents are privileged. I mean, I guess in a roundabout way, what it seems like the argument they're making is, hey, we have this work product, let's say it's an email, where we're debating amongst each other, and we don't want to release it because the Constitution says that we can't be liable for any civil action or criminal prosecution for debate. And so they're shoehorning that sentence to fit their needs so they don't have to release these documents to the public. The bottom line is, I believe it's against the law. I think this is going to lead to litigation. But on Friday, there was a legislative preview that happened in Olympia where members of the press gather and they can ask legislative leaders about what's coming up. And so, of course, legislative leaders were asked about why some lawmakers are exerting executive privilege. Now, House Minority Leader J.T. Wilcox spoke first, and he said, hey, you know, I don't use it, and I don't think Democrats should either.
It's never once occurred to me that, there must be some reason I can find that I shouldn't turn this over if it is responsive to the request. And so the idea that things that are difficult can be concealed seems counter to what the whole PRA, and very painful, as I might add, the PRA debate was all about a few years ago.
And then you had the Democrat in charge of the Senate, Andy Billig, and the Speaker of the House, Lori Jenkins, who spoke next, and essentially just sort of defended the continued use of this, saying, oh, well, we try to use it as little as possible, but it does exist, and they do believe it's covered by the Constitution.
I do believe that it exists. I do believe that it should be rarely used and very appropriately used, but it exists for the purpose of deliberation of the legislature.
So then journalists in the room start peppering them with more questions on this issue, and I shit you not, this is what happened when the pressure started to mount against these lawmakers over this legislative privilege issue?
Use it almost never because it only applies very infrequently.
Well, you still want me to answer? Maybe this means it's a really, really important thing.
Things are getting hot in here.
I think Kate is upset with us.
The freaking fire alarm went off. The fire alarm went off. So everyone evacuated the building, and then that was the end of this thing with legislative leaders, the Q&A. So just when the media starts to question them, the Democrats, on why they're using legislative privilege several times in the last few months, the freaking fire alarm goes off. You cannot make this stuff up. And they evacuate, and then they never come back to finish answering questions. So like I said on my newsletter on Sunday, you know, all that's going to happen here is news outlets are going to sue again. And it's going to be costly. It's going to cost taxpayers money. And at the end of the day, the courts are going to rule against lawmakers for using this. I guarantee it. So it's unnecessary and it's inappropriate. And I think it's against the law. And so I would highly recommend that you send an email to Senate Leader Andy Billig and House Speaker Lori Jenkins to demand that they drop this issue, pledge to stop using quote unquote legislative privilege and save us all from some costly drawn out legal battle that doesn't have to happen. Just do the right thing and pledge to do the right thing. So in my Sunday newsletter, I put links to email both the House Speaker and the Senate Leader. Please keep the email civil. No need to get nasty, but just let them know why you think this is an issue that they need to take the right side on and why you don't want them exerting legislative privilege when it comes to documents. It's a new year, new you. I've been really focused on losing my COVID weight the last couple months. As I told you guys, I've lost about 25 pounds so far. I have another 15 to go. I'm doing a little maintenance period. And then in February, I'll start back up on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan, which I began. I started it beginning of November. And then by the end of the year, I'd lost 25 pounds. One of the reasons why I was successful in this particular plan is, one, I thrive on structure. Like, I know how to lose weight, right? You exercise, you eat better. Why can't I just do it on my own? Well, I need that accountability built in. I need someone to tell me exactly what to do, and then I'll just treat it like a job. Okay, this is what I'm doing today. This is what I'm doing tomorrow and the next day, and I'm accountable to someone besides just myself, because apparently that hasn't been good enough so far. Also, I didn't have to buy any weird prepackaged meals or gross shakes or anything like that. I didn't have to go into an office to do the program. You can do it virtually. That's what I did. And look, is the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan magic? Of course not. I'm not going to be able to continue to eat the way I did when I gained 42 pounds during the pandemic. I'm just not, right? We're going to be realistic about this. But this helped really keep me on track. I think in the first week, I lost like 6 pounds. Week and a half, I lost like 6 pounds. So the motivation was through the roof to keep going. And now I'm just feeling so much better. Planning for a wedding, feeling healthier, and just really excited to continue going. So if you'd like to try the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan with me, you can check them out at eastsideweightlossclinic.com. Schedule a free consultation with Dr. Coogan, or you can call 425-354-3020. That's 425-354-3020. We've talked a lot on the podcast about some of these lying candidates who ended up getting elected. Of course, there's George Santos, the Republican, now member of Congress from New York's 3rd, who I can't even believe he got away with his lies. They were just outrageous. And then you had Clyde Shavers, who's a Democrat who was elected to the 10th Legislative District in Washington, claimed he was an attorney. He's not. Inflated his military service, which is weird. If you served your country, that's honorable. You don't have to inflate or exaggerate your military service. So there's been this talk about, okay, what can we do if opposition research isn't enough to catch these things early on? If the media is not catching these things early on, what can be done? You might not know that when you get with your ballot, you get a voter guide. And you have candidates who can write a little bit about themselves and their background, education, work experience in the voter guide. So if you're not familiar with them, you can read that and get to know them a little bit better. You might not know that no one fact checks the voter guide. candidates just write in it. You know, they could say that they've got a degree from Harvard, Yale, and no one is checking that information. It's contingent on the voters to do that. Well, a former Washington State Representative, Chad Magan-Dons, wrote an op-ed for the Seattle Times urging lawmakers to enact a law that would verify candidates' backgrounds for the voter pamphlet. He says this is something that could be done by elections officials. I invited him on the show to talk about it. Chad, welcome to Undivided. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Brandy.
You're a teacher, right? What do you teach?
I teach computer science. This is my fourth year teaching in the Bellevue School District.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, good for you. You look very teacher-esque right now.
This is my scruffy C-season look, yeah.
I like it. So before we dive into what your proposal is to deal with people who might be inclined to lie or embellish their resume, when you were running for office, what, if any, restrictions were put on you when it came to what you put on the voter guide?
Really nothing. I mean, there was just the word count limit. You could say pretty much anything you wanted. There was no validation of any information that you put on there, even though there were separate sections for your professional experience, your education, your elected experience. They didn't validate that at all, and they still don't.
Were you ever inclined then just to throw a few little sprinkles of falsities in there?
Yeah, there's always the temptation. And you know, I think that George Santos really felt the pressure to kind of, you know, check those intersectionality boxes to kind of lay claim to victim status, whether it's, you know, being Jewish. Or I've had people come up to me saying, oh, if only your name was actually Hispanic, you could be Magendez. And that would be a check that you could do on the intersectionality checklist. So there's definitely pressure to do that sort of thing. You know, personally, I wasn't tempted myself. And especially when it came to things like military service, you know, we veterans take stolen valor very seriously. And so, there was never any temptation to do that.
Yeah. And just for the record, because I imagine that's why one of the reasons the Seattle Times editorial board had you write something on this. Can you talk about your military service quickly?
Sure. I did 12 years in the U.S. Navy. I actually am a nuclear submarine officer. Unlike my shavers, I got my silver dolphins on the USS Georgia and then my gold dolphins on the Henry M. Jackson.
So let's talk about Clyde Shavers, because, you know, with the George Santos thing, I guess I'm very surprised from a journalistic perspective and also just the climate that we're living in where access to information is so easy. I'm surprised a candidate at that level could tell lies that big and not have it figured out pre-election. So I think there was just a lot of shortfalls there. But with races for state representative, am I wrong to think that there should be some level of opposition research that would have caught Clyde Shaver's lies sooner?
There should be. And I've worked in campaigns where that was a priority. It depends on the scale of a campaign. Like when I was running for Senate, we had funding to go do that research, and there were dedicated people that the party would use to do opposition research. And, you know, sometimes you end up with some really, you know, good stuff that you keep in your back pocket and drop when you're ready. When you're running a regular House campaign like mine, I was doing a lot of the work myself. And so I was, you know, maintaining my own website. I was writing, you know, designing my own yard signs, my own literature, my commercials. You know, I was basically a one-man team. And so sometimes you just don't have the time or the staff to be able to do that sort of research. And increasingly, neither do the editorial boards. I mean, we got fewer and fewer editorial boards, and they're stretched so thin. You know, they used to be that they would make that kind of candidate verification part of their process, and they're just not doing it anymore.
Yeah. So talk about what your proposal would be to try to weed out some of the lies that might arise.
So there are those three sections that are part of the voter's pamphlet right now, the professional experience, the educational experience, and the elected experience. And it seems like since those are already broken out, those would be relatively easy things to verify, particularly since election officials would have access to the ESD department for professional background. It's easy enough to run a transcript. You know, HR departments do that all the time. And of course, you can check with the PDC on elected experience. This is something that the Municipal League did when we did our candidate ratings. They did a partnership with candidate verification, a group that was started by David Dowd, and they did exactly that. You know, they verified your resume and actually did a criminal background check as well, which I think is also very important. And it was easy enough so that the King County Municipal League decided that it was going to be a requirement that they made for every single candidate that they were going to evaluate for their candidate ratings. And then McCloskey and like the Tacoma News Tribune, they jumped on board too. And so that was something that was done in 2014 and then kind of petered out. And I'd like to see a more robust version of that come back and kind of make it official as part of the process of submitting your information for the voter's pamphlet.
So if you're going to have, obviously, the government do this, I guess, to do the verification as part of that process, there's going to be questions about, well, who's going to do it for the government? If they're working for a Democrat, are they going to be fair and actually check the backgrounds of Democratic candidates, I guess? So how would you try to account for personal bias in that process as well?
Well, obviously, we can check the process itself. I mean, the parties will do that. They will, you know, basically audit certain candidates that have submitted, you know, and that could be part of your opposition research, is to make sure that the information in the voter's pamphlet is accurate and that the election officials are doing their job. But I chose those three categories specifically because they are fairly cut and dry. There's not a lot of interpretation needed to check a transcript.
Yeah, that's very true. And because there are some lies that are, you know, embellishments or stretches that are sort of like, do I call this a lie? Do I not call it a lie? And then I would wonder, and maybe this is just too into the weeds or far down to even get into, but part of me, like as a voter, I want to know who did lie, you know, and if somebody put that they, you know, went to Harvard or something and they didn't, is that something that would be released as part of the process or would it just be corrected and sent out to voters?
Well, what I was imagining, and again, this process is something we would iterate on with the legislation as we draft the language, but I was expecting that there'd be an opportunity for the candidate to correct the error, okay? And that if they refuse to do that, there would be a disclaimer at the bottom of the pamphlet that basically said we were unable to verify this person's, you know, college degree or work experience or military experience, something like that.
Yeah, I like that. And just to round things out, you know, for Clyde Shavers, a lot of his lies were told, you know, in verbally to groups, or they were sent out on campaign mailers, you know, saying he was an environmental attorney. Mm-hmm. So I guess I mean, there's no way to prevent a candidate from speaking lies to people. But when it comes to putting a lie on an official campaign mailer that came from your campaign, is there anything prohibiting that?
There isn't. And if you look at the actual RCW, there's a lot of material out there to protect other people from saying falsehoods about you. Although Times v. Sullivan made that bar very high in a campaign. But you can't do that to yourself. I mean, if you make false statements about yourself, that's not covered under libel or slander. Right. So, there's really no mechanism for you legally to go after these people for falsehoods in stuff that they would say on the campaign trail.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very easy step, and I think it's the least we can do. I mean, to assume that voters can get one of those guides and they're going to go through and on their own fact check all these things is just ridiculous. Former State Representative Chad Magandans, I appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Brandy.
The following segment is brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Last week on the show, I told you we're going to be looking for more opportunities, more stories about the people being the watchdog. I talked about the death of my friend Dory Monson and how I think he was one of, if not the most effective watchdogs of government in Washington state, and his loss leaves a huge void there. And in the absence of a robust and effective media climate, more and more people have to be their own watchdogs. They have to stand up when they see something that's not right, and they have to do something because you can't rely on the media to do it. You can't rely on politicians always to do the right thing. There's a great example of this happening up in Linwood, Washington right now, where residents are protesting, speaking out about the fact that the state of Washington and Acadia Health are about to open up an opioid treatment center in Linwood. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You need these treatment centers to be somewhere. The problem is, it is just a few yards from a Boys and Girls Club, which is supposed to be a safe place for young kids and teens. And so you have all these parents who are like, what the heck? One, we didn't even know about this. Nobody told us until December 29th was the first opportunity for public input. This thing was scheduled to open at the end of this month. So you give people a month when you've clearly already decided that you're going to open it. The permits are in place. It's been remodeled. So it's like the state was just checking off boxes to say, oh, it requires public input, check, but not really listening. One of the other people very upset with the way all this went down was Linwood City Council President George Hurst. He did testify during that public hearing on December 29th. Here's a bit of that.
I feel we are just part of a check-the-box process. The state will hold a public hearing, check. Acadia will meet with the council, check. A few stakeholders will be briefly contacted with a short visit or voicemail that is left, check, check. All happening after the tenant improvement for the OTP has been finished and is ready for occupancy at a site a few hundred feet from the Alderwood Boys and Girls Club.
I invited Council President Hurst on the show to talk about how all of this went down, his real frustration with the state and Acadia Health not doing more to take the concerns of the public to heart. When did you first become aware of what was going on with this new clinic and its proximity to the Boys and Girls Club?
Right. On December 12th, the City Council was sent an email from the State Department of Health. And in it was a letter that said there was a proposed opioid treatment program in Linwood, had an incorrect address on it. And then the letter stated that there was a public hearing, would be a public hearing on August 16th, 2022. And yeah, a lot of it didn't make sense. And this was the last day of our council meeting, and that we had six ordinances we needed to pass. And here's this email showing up at 11 a.m. that day. And so I set it aside because I thought, well, they're talking about an old public hearing, you know, not quite clear what was going on. So it wasn't until I think it was December 14th, I was meeting with the mayor to talk about what we had done at our council meeting on the 12th. And she said, well, she pointed out a local media that had a notice of a public hearing of the Department of Health that was going to be on December 29th at 4:30 p.m. And she said, at that time, no one at the city knows anything about this. I went, okay. So then I sent out some emails to the Department of Health and said, what's going on? They sent that same letter they had sent before, but with a corrected public hearing date. And then sent us some forms that the city council was expected to fill out. And on these forms, you know, I'm looking at it right now because it talks about, you know, has the provider contacted you? It has the location of the OTP. Is it in accordance with appropriate city land use ordinances? It was like, well, I wrote back and just said, no, we don't know. We have not been contacted. We do not know anything about this because I was believing the mayor, and I sent it back off to the Department of Health. So then they responded to me and said that, I think it was on December 20th, that the provider would be contacting the city council to talk about the program. And so I waited, so that was the 20th, so I didn't get anything from them until an email on the 28th, which is the day before the public hearing. And Acadia Health said, oh, I'm introducing myself. And, you know, we want to let you know about what's the program is all about. And I wrote back and said, well, you're about 2 or 3 weeks late in this email. And there's a public hearing tomorrow. You know, basically, I said, I'll invite you to the January 3rd city council meeting so you can tell us all about it. Because at that point, I thought, yeah, we just want to know what's going on. Right. Well, then I find out that actually the tenant space was basically ready to be occupied. It had been remodeled. It had this is where the downfall of communication. So our city planning department was notified in March of 2022 that Acadia intended to come in because they were head of facility in Bothell, and that building apparently was sold and they were losing their lease. So they wanted to move into Linwood. So our planning department knew about it in March. Acadia applied for a permit in June. They were approved September, October. So this remodel was going on while the council was oblivious. And really, you know, most tenant improvements in the city of Linwood, the council doesn't get involved in that. That is the planning department's bailiwick. But you would think that once they knew, and in March they knew it was a methadone clinic, that they would start thinking, why the wisdom of placing this clinic basically across the street or right near the Alderwood Boys and Girls Club? Wouldn't they have asked somebody or told somebody? But anyway, the gist of it is December 16th were final inspections by our city for this tenant space. So it's ready to go. I've been told they want to occupy January 23rd. And so it turns out that this public hearing that Department of Health held during a holiday week at 4:30, that really hardly anyone knew about, you know, we started asking questions, you know, how did this happen? What kind of mitigation is there for this being close to the Boys and Girls Club? And then at the end of the hearing, when at least three council members spoke about how we really had no clue what was going on, the Department of Health says, well, we'll answer your questions in 2 weeks. That's mid-January, and they intend to move in January 23rd. It just was, it just seemed like it was being set up for a massive protest by the neighbors. I don't blame them. You know, they just seemed blindsided, and so did we.
It's a comedy of errors, and I hate to even laugh about it, but it's just so indicative of, and you stated it really perfectly in the testimony you gave. It just felt like, oh, we've got to check these boxes. We have no interest in actually listening to input, but there are boxes we have to check. Just devil's advocate with the planning department, would there be any reason that your planning department thought you didn't know about it?
Yes, the director of our planning department, he talked to us at our last council meeting, and he said that Acadia told them they would take care of the outreach. They are required to do some outreach. And so, if you're a planning person, what you're looking at are the plans, the permits, and if somebody's going to tell you they're going to do outreach, then, you know, you assume they're going to do that. But, you know, as was clear on our Monday council meeting, they did not reach out to Alderwood Boys and Girls Club. They did not reach out to the Edmond School District, which considers the Alderwood Boys and Girls Club a preferred after-school program. They did not approach even some of the tenants within this building, which is, that's kind of unique because the owner of the building is the dentist. But he has another dentist that shares space. That dentist contacted me and said he didn't know anything about this until he finally started asking questions. What's going on in this TI space? And it was the contractor that told him it was a methadone clinic. So he's looking at, well, how is this going to impact his business? There's so many problems with this site. It's just not the Boys and Girls Club. It's the fact that this is on the border of the city limits. So on one side of the street, it is Linwood City. On the other side of the street is unincorporated Snohomish County. If there's a situation or a problem, what jurisdiction responds? Is it Snohomish County Sheriff? Is it Linwood Police? You know, not anticipating there'll be problems, but what if there is? You know, it just, and the bus service that they say that, you know, they want someplace where there's a lot of transit. There's not that much of a bus service in this area. So it's so many problems. And what is bothering my heart is that, so this Bothell clinic, the clinic in Bothell serves 300 clients. And these are folks that are trying to fight drug addiction through methadone. But if this new site is not given a license, where do these 300 people go? If the Bothell space, you know, if they've lost their lease. And really it's up to the Department of Health, State Department of Health, to provide the license. They haven't done that yet. They say they're waiting, you know, they're waiting for our correspondence, you know, but basically the correspondence really is a checklist. You know, we have to say, yes, this site does meet appropriate city ordinances and business license and all that, because they've done that. It just wasn't a very transparent process on this. And I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but, you know, on Monday, the mayor and council leadership is talking to our city attorney to see if there's anything that can be done. Just maybe to delay it, to get some sort of, if this site has to go through, let's get some sort of mitigation plan. You know, Acadia has said they'll provide security, fine. But what about, we would don't want people to be lining up at this center. We don't want people to, there's only one lobby, one entrance. So, you know, do they fill the lobby and then the clients for the dental people on the second floor, they have to go through that lobby? Not that people, you know, it just is, seems very odd way to deal with the clinic in this area.
Yeah, and nobody's saying, and just to get this out there, because there'll always be those people who are like, oh, you're NIMBYs, you just don't want it anywhere in your city. It's not about, common sense people realize you need to have centers like this for people to get help, but I think it's right. A very legitimate criticism to wonder where the communication was and to wonder, this close to a Boys and Girls Club, is that really the only place you could find for it? You talked earlier, you alluded to the community anger over this, and they've gone out, yeah, and they've protested. What do you make of that? I mean, it's not every day Lynnwood has a sort of community uprising of that nature.
Yeah, no, they're very social media savvy people. That's how they organized, and that's great. The ironic part of this is most of them probably are not, quote, city residents. They are probably unincorporated Snohomish residents who have a Lynnwood address, but that doesn't matter. What really matters is we have to figure out a way. If this is going to happen, we have to figure out a way to make them feel safe. We have to figure out a way to, I'm almost thinking about, can we form some sort of oversight committee with these folks who are so interested in what's going on, and they want to make sure that their community is safe. The ironic thing though, is that there was comments about the Alderwood Boys and Girls Club that they have problems with drug use there now. They have to take their vans home so that they aren't vandalized in any way. So if this is a problem area, I think Lynnwood Police, now we know the Alderwood Boys and Girls Club is in the city of Lynnwood. It's our jurisdiction. Maybe we need to do an emphasis patrol there and help that area be safe as well. And maybe this clinic would draw attention to the fact that, we need more security up there, and let's clean up this neighborhood.
And just to be clear, you're not saying that there's drug use in the Boys and Girls Club. You're saying around it there have been some...
On their property. Yeah, they find needles. There's transients. The neighbors complained about people parking on the streets and cars, drug deals happening. This is all, just hearsay, of course, but it's a real concern for those folks. So yeah, I was really impressed with how they came. They talked, they told us their concerns. They are a really good group dedicated to their neighborhood, and that type of engagement, man, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I don't like to think the worst of people and the worst intentions, but when you, as we started, listed off all the things that had kind of been promised or gone wrong that was supposed to happen that didn't, going back to March, and then you get this email saying, oh, there's going to be a public testimony for a date that's 5 months in the past. Do you think any of this was intentionally to prevent any sort of input until it was too late? Or do you think it was just sort of a lot of unfortunate oversights?
I think on the part of the State Department of Health, I think they copy and pasted a letter, and had the wrong date in it. What I got from our council meeting, I did invite the Department of Health to be there, and they could do it via Zoom, and it was great. There were four of them there, but they were, all they were interested in is making sure they complied with the RCW and made sure that all the steps were being followed. And yes, they are being followed, but there are just some ramifications for these actions that we need to look at. I am not as, I think Acadia, they have, I think, eight methadone clinics in the state of Washington. They have over 150 somewhere in the United States. They are very experienced, and I think they're experienced at keeping things at a low level of information. And, I think that's their outreach was terrible. When they were supposed to contact the Edmond School District, a voicemail was left at a general phone number, and no follow up. They contacted our police department. We have a community health and safety division. They contacted the sergeant via email. on this and said, hey, this was in September. Hey, we're coming into your town. We like that you have this division. We would like to cooperate with you. You know, we're going to let you know what's happening. But that was it. That was it. One email, no other response. You know, obviously they didn't contact the city council and let us know what was going on. Their outreach, like I said, they didn't contact the Alderwood Boys and Girls Club. Their other, there's a working small education farm not far away that they do things with school kids. They were never contacted. It was like, you know, really? You just, you know, you did the minimum. You did the minimum to fill out your little form to say that you did some sort of outreach. But, and they say, well, this is the outreach program is a dynamic thing. You know, it grows and, you know, when there's concerns, we'll change and all that. But that doesn't help the fact that at the beginning, people felt like, where did this all come from? You know,
and yeah, now I'm getting, rightfully so.
Yeah. And now I'm getting an email I got was, it may be that the owner of the building wasn't quite clear what type of clinic was going in, because when the permit was requested, it was just called a medical clinic, which fit into the zone that this building was. But, you know, an idea, yeah, if a TI of a medical clinic in an existing medical building, yeah, that sounds pretty, you know, safe. But when you put in opiate treatment program, or more likely methadone clinic, then I think that would light up some, you know, warning signals.
Just
let people know what's going on.
Right. And then you plan for it. Like you said, I mean, you have to be honest about public safety risks that come along with that, about there being kids nearby. I mean, it's just common sense stuff. And I think a lot of this could have been avoided had there been earlier, better communication. If there is a reassessment, a true reassessment of this location, are you willing to work, and is the city willing to work with Acadia to perhaps find a better location to suit their needs?
Yes. You know, the Bothell location was in Canyon Park, a light industrial area. We have light industrial areas around Highway 99, which has a superior bus system. If people, you know, want to use a bus, what I've been told, most of the clients, they actually drive, and it's a 10-minute visit to get the methadone. Then they're off to, you know, a job or their family, you know, just to, because they needed the help to fight the addiction. But yeah, I can't believe they could not find a location on 99 or somewhere in a light industrial area in our city instead of a residential area with a Boys and Girls Club across the street. It boggles the imagination, you know, the mind. Yeah.
It truly does. I mean, you had also on that public testimony quickly, there was a Democratic state lawmaker who testified on behalf of it. Have you tried reaching out to her office to express your concerns?
Yes. Yeah. That's Rep. Lauren Davis. Mm-hmm. You know, her focus in the legislature is drug addiction and mental health. You know, I trust her judgment and her knowledge of what methadone does. In fact, one of the things she talked about at our council meeting was that we really now in Snohomish County have a fentanyl problem, and that methadone is the only thing that really kicks the fentanyl addiction. But at the same time, I know, you know, Lauren says she welcomes this clinic. I think I do too, but not in this location. And I know that sounds pretty NIMBY, and she knows that, you know, her comment was, you know, every clinic has objections to it, right? But this one just seems to be so severe, you know. But you know, we in Lenwood we're building a new community justice center, which is a police jail facility. But right adjacent to it, within the same building, is a community recovery center. So we're going to have people there for mental health and drug addiction, and a methadone clinic in our city would be really helpful for those folks there who are seeking the treatment. But yeah, let's get it closer to that facility. Not on the outskirts of Lenwood, maybe, you know, let's get it. I still think somewhere in 99 on Highway 99, we could get a good facility there, and it would be a win for everyone.
Yeah, and I don't think it sounds NIMBY at all. I think that's one of the, you know, we're so into labeling, and we see that a lot in Seattle, that label NIMBY, when you express concern about, you know, the homeless crisis and it's spilling right into city parks. And it's like, no, you know, we should be able to have reasonable conversations about legitimate concerns, and this is a legitimate concern. So I hope you guys can work things out up there. I've been fascinated by it. Whenever the community comes up like that, so grassroots, it's like you said, I mean, awesome that they care so much.
Yeah. No. And, you know, we're going to keep in touch with them and let them know all these steps, because we're going to be very transparent on this process. You know, whether it's we were somehow able to move this clinic, or if we can't, then we're going to figure out a way to make it work. We, you know, it just is so unfortunate. It's like it was set up to become a huge problem, and it should have been. Like you say, education should have occurred. If we could have started talking about this in the summer and talk and get the community together and the neighbors together and figure out this thing. But to do this all on a holiday week at 4:30, have a public hearing, it's what is the State Department of Health thinking?
So we are going to be staying all over this story. Again, it's a great example of what can happen when the public decides to be its own watchdog, when the public decides to push back, make their voices heard. It can be a very effective thing. And we know that the state is now kind of reconsidering things, reevaluating things, given how much public pushback there has been. The previous segment was brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Okay, last story I want to get to today, and then I'll read some comments from you guys on some other stories we've been working on. So, January 6th, obviously you had the Capitol riot, which was the big news, but then simultaneously there was a breaching of the governor's mansion in Olympia, which is incredibly serious. You know, the governor and his wife were home. My understanding is they had to hide in a closet. So this was a terrifying ordeal. Members of the media were threatened. So I don't want anything I say after this to downplay what happened. Anytime you have an incident like this, it's incredibly serious and terrifying. And I just think of the governor and his wife, Trudy, who's just a gem, sitting in a closet, just scared. And that's awful. I just could not help, though, but be a little frustrated with an article that was written on it. Crosscut, which I keep defining as the leftist Seattle Times, they posted an article saying what happened after the January 6th confrontation in Olympia. So it was basically a article following up on the people who were arrested, what the charges were, whether charges were dropped, etc. And then it replayed the course of events through the words of people who were there, including some journalists. And the subhead on this article is, since the 2021 attack on the Capitol campus, security has increased, two people have faced prosecution, and reporters continue to feel the shock. Okay. So far, none of this bothers me. And honestly, it's not the article itself that bothers me, because there's this reporter who was there and she's quoted in it saying about the day, it started off pretty normal. They started making all these claims of election fraud and it started getting more and more heated. And then it goes into kind of the horror of threats against journalists. You know, there was some protester allegedly who said, let's kill all the journalists or something like that. So bad stuff. But I can't help but wonder, this is a very lengthy article that rehashes this. I have never seen anything even remotely close to this to reflect on what happened in the summer of 2020. You know, as a journalist who was physically attacked in the summer of 2020, who sought refuge in a fire station, who had a hard time going out in public after that without an anxiety attack, I've never seen any sort of reflection like this on the violence that occurred in the summer of 2020, on the people who were killed in Chop. And to me, it just reeks of, again, I think this is a fine story. I think it's an important story. I want to know what happened to these people. I'm fine with reporters talking about how insane this was for them and how scary this was for them. But you think that Crosscut would call me up and ask me to recount how scary the summer of 2020 was for me? How scary being mobbed at CHOP was for me and let me reflect on that? Of course not. I mean, if they want to call me, they're welcome to do it. But it just shows this crazy level of bias. I think this story should be done, but I think that's a story that should have been done as well. We tend to just compartmentalize acts of political violence depending on what party, the media does this, depending on what party was at the center of them or what the cause was at the center of them. I don't care what your cause was. Threatening a journalist, attacking a journalist, threatening a politician, attacking a politician, breaching the Capitol, breaching the governor's mansion, it's all wrong. And the lack of moral consistency from the media on this is staggering. Because as you know, an entity in the media, we should be lockstep in condemning, in highlighting, in pushing back against any violence against journalists, no matter who perpetrates it. So to see, you know, a couple of journalists in here talking about the horror of this day 2 years ago, I just can't help but be a little pissed off at their unwillingness to highlight how horrible Chaz Chop was for some journalists, how horrible the riot in downtown Seattle in 2020 was for some journalists. And so, you know, Crosscut, I think this is very true to form for them, but I'm really disappointed in how one-sided they are when it comes to violence towards members of the media. Okay, you guys might have seen this. I posed a challenge to some Twitter haters, which I thought, gosh, there's so many people who hate me on Twitter in Seattle that they ought to jump at this opportunity. I tweeted, just admit that Governor Inslee's vaccine mandate as it exists today without a booster mandate is about obedience. If anyone can give me a different factual basis for it rooted in health, I'll end my podcast and delete Twitter. That is a remarkable opportunity for my Twitter haters, but none of them have been able to give me a factual basis for it that's rooted in health. Now, I don't think there should be a booster mandate. I'm glad there isn't. But I also don't think there should be a mandate for the original vaccine, because the state mandate right now is you have to have had the original vaccine or you cannot be employed by the state unless you have some approved exemption. But since there isn't a vaccine booster mandate with it, then the original mandate no longer makes sense, because we know from the CDC that vaccine efficacy wanes after about 6 months. So if I'm a state worker who a year and a few months ago, yeah, I got a vaccine to comply, but I didn't get a booster, I'm not protected anymore. So the whole point I'm making is if the governor wants to be consistent in saying we need all our state workers to be protected with the vaccine, then you'd have to have a booster mandate. I don't want him to, but you'd have to in order to make this make any level of sense. And so I am very confident I'm going to be able to keep my podcast and keep my Twitter account, because I just don't think anybody's going to have a great explanation for that. But let's see, I had some comments from you guys to my challenge I posed to my haters. Christy said, same with the mask mandate in the front office and waiting areas of dental offices. It's all about control and it needs to end. Yeah, the dental offices were tough because it's like, I'm going to go in there and open my mouth wide for you. So it's like, why do I need to wear this mask in the entry area? That makes no sense. Cheryl says, they are offering state employees $1,000 if they get boosted anytime in 2023. Why? Why the need to use taxpayer money to pay people? Insane. Yeah, I agree. It's just a bribe at that point. And I had a lot of people who said, thank you for finally speaking the truth on this. I've been talking about this for more than a year about how this is ridiculous. And even when I was in mainstream media at Fox, I was pushing back heavy against the mayor of Seattle, the governor, for doing this, you know, for police officers and for firefighters when we already had a worker shortage. I will say, and this is the first time I'm ever saying this, I do regret getting the COVID vaccine. I'm sure they'll take this video off YouTube now. I regret getting it because, you know, I got it right away when I could, because I really thought that it was the path out of the lockdowns. And in Washington State, those lockdowns were getting so, so old. And I thought, okay, if I'm going to be able to do more things with this vaccine card, I'm going to do it. But when it became clear after I'd gotten that initial dose that the breakthrough cases were the normal, that it wasn't going to stop me from getting and spreading it, I was sort of like, okay, I didn't need to do that. I'm young, I'm healthy. So I never ended up getting boosters. And I do kind of, some of these things that have come out about the vaccine, you know, Johnson & Johnson, there being this recommendation to shy away from Johnson & Johnson in favor of other vaccines, and some of the things that have come out. This is the first time I'm saying it, and I do regret getting it. I just don't think I needed it. I don't think I needed to take any risk in getting it. And I already got, I got very, very sick from COVID with the vaccine. So I don't think it did anything for me. So yeah, I do regret getting the vaccine. I just at the time felt like it was kind of the only option to be able to move forward. All right, that's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. If you like the show, we have a goal to add 250 new subscribers this month to help us expand this mission. Why not be one of them? You can do it for $5 a month. Patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com.